Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Michael Kohlberg, and I am a psychotherapist in New York City and in Hudson, New York, today calling from New York City. It is Thursday, September 29th, 2016, and I'm here with my friend Anne. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Michael. I'm up here on the Upper East Side, and I just recently leaped out of my bed and went, oh, my God, it's almost 10. I'm recovering from a bit of a cold, and
okay.
I'm broadcasting from the bright red desk. So here we are at the last bit of September. The last gasp as we're about to go into real full fall. And it's cold out today. It's cold out this morning.
It's cool.
It's cool, yeah. So what's new and exciting in your world? Did you watch the debates?
I didn't.
I
started to.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I was going to feel worse afterwards. So I didn't. And then I got up, you know, a couple hours later in the night, and I started reading about things, and then I continued the next day.
Got it. Yeah.
But I didn't think I was going to be helped by having the actual experience.
Oh, okay. See, I have no television, right? So I usually watch little video clips and read magazines.
Right.
And stuff. And I decided I needed to watch the debates.
And look what it did
so
to you.
So I went out there.
And look what it did to you.
And look what it did to me. I went out there and found Bloomberg live streaming and watched it on courtesy of Mr. Bloomberg, Bloomberg Television. And it was really interesting, I have to say.
Talk.
Yeah, it was just kind of, you know, I don't have a TV, so one of my friends, Mark, keeps saying, when is he going to be off my TV? When is he going to be out of my living room? So I haven't really seen a lot of him. And I've read, you know, like you do, I've read more of the stuff he's been saying. So it was very interesting to watch him. But I don't think they told him he was going to be on split screen because he was sitting there wiggling and jumping and sniffing and watering. And then my friends that are cocaine people, so I've never done cocaine in my life because I have an addictive personality and I knew that was not a good thing for me. They all were like, he's doing cocaine. He's got this sniffing thing going. And Hillary did pretty well. She held her own. She didn't come off as warm, but she came off as friendly. So it was interesting, you know, because she gets a bad rap because she's a Scorpio. And a lot of times Scorpios, people go, oh, she's a Scorpio. And she came across pretty good. So it was good to watch. And then, of course, Rudy Giuliani said, I told Donald not to do any more debates. And I'm like, oh, please, come on. So we'll see if he shows up again for the rest of them. Because, you know, we looked at the chart for the debate, and that might be the only one. He'll only do the one debate, and he'll bail on the other two. But it was very good. Hillary definitely had some prod points with him. Prodded him when she said he didn't pay any taxes. He bit on that one, and it does look like he, in fact, does not pay any taxes. It's smart not to pay taxes, you know, and it's kind of like, I pay taxes. I don't know about you, but I do. So, but she referenced two of his earlier tax returns when he filed with New Jersey trying to get casinos where he said he didn't pay any taxes. It was interesting. And what was your impression from what you read?
That I did a smart thing by not having the experience. And no, seriously. That made me sad.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he did badly enough to
disqualify himself.
Right.
Right. No, he didn't.
Which is, again, a reflection of the world we're living in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because he clearly is not qualified to be in a situation where one needs to exercise restraint.
Right, right.
And
not push the nuclear button.
Yeah.
Well, and you can see Hillary goad him right into reacting. So,
it's
very
easy
to set him off, huh?
Yeah. So. I mean, you know, I absolutely have no expertise or evidence in this, but it seemed to me like he had taken a beta blocker. Because he was kind of normal for a short time until he got goaded,
mm-hmm.
and that triggered his character disorder, and then he was off the rails.
Oh, okay.
But at the beginning, he seemed on track.
What does that mean, taking a beta blocker?
My understanding of them, it's a heart drug, and people take them if they have a lot of stage anxiety so that they can be calmer when they speak in public.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Do you think he was on that and then it wore off?
Well, I think it's a mild thing. So I think once his character disorder got triggered, mm-hmm. he was ambushed or kidnapped by it. I mean, that's normally his state, is he just gives into personality rather than anything else, and everything is about defending himself against the void that exists within him.
Can you talk a little bit more about character disorder?
Well, in the DSM, which is really the diagnostic manual that the mental health professions use supposedly, but really what it is for psychiatrists who often don't have a great deal of life experience or insight, and for insurance companies, it's a group of disorders. Narcissism is one. Borderline personality disorder is another. There are a couple, but they're the hardest things because they're character disorders. So they're hard to deal with because you really do need to pay a great deal of attention to wanting to get better.
Mm-hmm.
However, your character keeps getting in the way of that. So
kind of like taking over the show kind of thing?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
So is it like there's two parts of you?
Well, everybody's got many parts of themselves.
Okay.
But this is a part that insists on running the show. And it, with narcissistic personality disorder, at least my understanding of it, is that infants often get, or hopefully get, mirrored. So when they're happy, their parents are, reflect happy back to them. So that you have a mirror, so that somebody is seeing how you are when you're an infant, and they're reflecting it back to you. Your internal experience is being validated.
Mm-hmm.
But with people who end up with a narcissistic personality disorder, in fact, that often doesn't happen. And they need to reach out in order to feel attached. So nobody's coming to them going, I see you. Rather, they need to create a sense of existence from the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't really develop much internal experience.
Mm-hmm.
So with him, and then what happens is they're either highly grandiose or they feel absolutely defeated.
Okay.
And that is dictated by what happens to them from the outside.
Got it.
So with Trump, he's constantly defending his grandiosity by belittling anything that disagrees with him.
Right.
Like, he cannot exist in a field where there's disagreement without
attacking it.
And the reason he's attacking it is because he must see himself as other than the void that at some level he is
mm-hmm.
experiencing. And so he fills himself with external stuff. And so, like, for instance, truth goes out the window.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to maintain complexity goes out the window. Curiosity about the self goes out the window.
Why do they get sacrificed?
Because he needs to have a vision of the world that supports his need to feel superior.
So then when he says, I didn't say that, he really believes it.
Yeah.
Well, even though they go, here's where you did it.
Well, I mean,
like,
if he was curious about it, he would risk feeling wrong. And if he feels wrong, he doesn't have, it's not like I feel wrong, let me see what I can learn from this. Rather, it's wrong, therefore I'm without any value.
I cease to exist. Okay. Well.
Right.
Now, I had never heard that another way it showed up was despondency. But those are the people that kind of live in the little the paranoids that kind of live in the house and hide from the world?
Paranoid is something else. So I don't want to go down that road. I'm sure that there's a seasoning of paranoia, perhaps, but I don't know that there's an awareness of that always. It's just that.
I'd never heard of it in a form not bragging about themselves. That's what I mean by that.
Well, that's but there's a time when there's utter defeat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the circumstances. So there's a constant need to defend against having that experience.
Got it.
Because that's a void. It's just an emptiness.
So if he loses the election, he's going to be pretty bad.
I don't know, because he's very, very well defended.
Okay.
And he may just go, thank God I didn't have to do that, and look how much money I made because of it.
Okay.
Whether or not he did.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize that was the core structure. So you think it's because, well, he was the fourth of five kids.
I don't know.
But that's
not necessarily
that the mother did anything wrong.
I don't know that he had stuff reflected back to him. And I don't know that birth order has to do anything with it.
You don't know that a parent, it does not necessarily related to the parent?
A parent, yes.
It is.
I mean, this is not stuff I studied in depth.
I know, but you know more than 90% of the world. Yeah.
Wait, this is not where my interest is. The way it was explained to me that, from the person I trust the most, is it's infrequent that somebody fits neatly into these little boxes. They're meant for other purposes,
right,
especially now for insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't go through life being necessarily the same all the time. So under incredible stress, somebody may exhibit more aspects of this and fewer aspects of that. And then when their life is calmer, they may be less regressed, and they may, express or display more aspects of something else and fewer of this. So we just kind of go in and out of stuff. But he seems pretty consistently to be one thing. And all you have to do is prick him,
mm-hmm,
and he's off and running, defending himself.
Right. Not even a prick, just the threat of a pin.
Yeah, but that's a prick. You know, a pin can...
He sees it coming.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. No, I'd never heard it explained. I mean, you can certainly see it in a chart and say to people, oh, looks like your ex-husband was a little narcissistic, or your ex-wife was a little narcissistic. And I know it's not treatable. It's like borderline personality.
Well, both of those things are treatable. That's not true.
But most people don't go in for treatment.
But when they do,
it can be fixed.
It's not a question of it can be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of, number one, it's a somewhat courageous thing to deal with. And it takes a lot of effort.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen people who are able to move beyond that stuff,
mm-hmm,
both borderline stuff and narcissistic personality disorder, borderline stuff. That was kind of the diagnosis of our time a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot remember her name, but there's a woman who put a lot of stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy,
mm-hmm,
which is now popular with a lot of stuff. They use it with people recovering from addictions as well. But it's five modalities that are put together, and one is impulse control, one is mindfulness. There are a bunch of things that are taught together which help people calm themselves down enough so that they have the capacity to learn some tools that will really help them tolerate a lot of discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes... I think a great deal of courage. I've worked with a few people who have really taken the responsibility to help themselves develop capacities that they were not born with in dealing with this stuff. So they still may have the initial out-of-the-gate impulses in a certain direction, but they also have the capacity to work with themselves out of the gate and shift things a bit. You know, the human soul is yearning to find ways to tolerate more light. So if we get the personality out of the way and really connect with that soul, I think a lot of healing can happen.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, the diagnosis that I personally have discovered, where you just stay away from it, period, is malignant narcissism. And M. Scott Peck wrote a book. He's the person who wrote The Road Less Traveled,
I love that book, yeah.
Yeah. But
life
he also,
is difficult, it opens with. I'm like, wow, I guess you're staking a premise, but let's talk about how to do it.
Right. But the he wrote a very controversial book in the early 80s, I think, called People of the Lie.
Yes.
And
yes.
That book explains the diagnosis of malignant narcissism. And that is one that I think is totally intractable. It's and the premise is, if the DSM had a diagnosis of evil, what would it be?
Okay.
So that's, you know, that's way down the food chain. It's a particular kind of
narcissism.
Yeah.
And why is it so untreatable?
Well, I think there's a desire to harm.
Oh, okay. Got it.
You know, that's the...
That's a component of it.
That's the signature component.
Yeah.
Okay. And that they're very, very good at sucking people towards them, and when you go through a particular veil, you end up confused. So I don't want to linger on that, like, because I just don't want that energy around me, but it's People of the Lie is the name of the book, and I always advise people, and I only suggest it when people are having the experience of being around it, and but you read it in one sitting. Don't spread it out.
And do you think Donald has that?
I don't know. Really... No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
Because that would be even worse than, yeah.
No, I don't. I don't think he's that.
He's that. Okay. Those are the people that kill the kitties.
No, that's different.
Different than that, too?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So,
I'll have to go read this book, People of the Lie.
Yeah. It's, I helped somebody through it once, and then it wasn't a patient. It wasn't a friend. It was somebody who came to me, and I don't remember how. But then she was having this experience, and I helped her through it. And then I was having the experience, and she said, "Here," and gave me this book, and I read it all at once. And once you see it, something gets a light switch goes on, and then forever after. You see it when it's coming, and you just stay away.
Okay. You're able to spot it.
Yep.
Cool. Interesting. I had not heard that one. I love The Road Less Traveled, though. I remember reading that, being very profoundly affected by it. He's a good writer.
So what I'm seeing in all of my patients this week, uh-huh. except for a couple, is extraordinary anxiety.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I'll just go over the tools, because hopefully it can help people,
mm-hmm.
is number one, realize that you are extraordinarily anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number two, become very interested in becoming unanxious. Because anxiety, when you suffer from anxiety, you are really suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So a therapist I worked with, a long time ago, suggested that anxiety is a signal from you to yourself that you've disconnected from yourself.
Oh, okay.
And I found that very useful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if I'm feeling really anxious, I go, okay, where have I lost connection with myself?
Right.
Because by definition, I'm going to be much less stable. And then I become much more interested in what's going on inside of me than outside of me. And I put whatever's triggering the anxiety over on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I go off by myself. And I go, okay, what can I do? You know, how can I help myself? So it's almost like there's a part of me that's the adult and a part of me that's a child. Any child I've ever been because when you're really anxious, your whole screen is filled with, I'm really anxious.
Right.
And it's often experienced by immersion in whatever the substance of what's creating anxiety is. But try to just remove that. So you're just having the pure feeling, and you go, what can I do? I'm right here, listening. So the child can be invited to share their experience with the adult part of you. And you just go, you know, I'm listening, and I really want to hear what's going on. I feel incredibly, I see that. I hear that. What does it feel like? And then as each layer gets processed, you go, well, I can't fix this, but I can be with you. You're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, you, number one, reconnect with yourself. And number two, you start to build a muscle, which is really your observer self.
Right.
And Catherine Woodward Thomas, who was the author and the inventor of a process called A Calling in the One, did a beautiful job of creating an exercise when I studied that helps people go through this process. But you just debrief the child part of you and let them know that they're not alone. They're not floating out in space, but that the adult part of you is also there, and that the adult part of you, which is able to hold complexity, and the child part cannot, and the adult part of us is capable of leaving any unsafe situation.
Right.
So, and where the child part of us is not.
Right.
And in doing that, you really reinforce the fact that you have a lot of internal capabilities that are not necessarily apparent when you're flipping out.
That you're not even paying attention to, but when you pause, you go,
well,
yeah,
I think that there's a trigger that happens when you get frightened.
Yep.
And then you get frantic because you're very mesmerized, hypnotized by whatever's creating that fear, rather than remaining curious about the experience being had in that moment.
How do I work with it? Yeah. Makes sense. It definitely has a... the reason the anxiety is the Uranus-Pluto conjunction, Uranus-Eris, rather, when they met in June when we had the gay massacre. We just had a big train wreck this morning in Hoboken, and when Hillary broke the glass ceiling, and now she had the debate, and when Britain left the EU... that week, when we had all that, and the kid getting eaten by the alligator, carried off by the crocodile. So we're having that again this week, that energy. We're also having Pluto going direct, which went on Monday, so we have till Friday. And then on Friday, the anxiety really, really is going to drop. We're going to feel much more, okay, this is the reality, I can work with this. Because right now, we're doing the last bits of the release of the eclipse, which started mid-August, which brought to light a really big situation in many of our lives. And at the end, on Friday, afternoon, evening, we go, okay, this is the plan, I'm ready. Because all this, up until then, it's very unstable. So I guess the train from the reports in the radio this morning went full steam into the wall at the end and ran over the, took down the roof of the train, and there's a lot of injuries in New Jersey.
Right.
And then, of course, the other trains keep coming into the Hoboken station, you know, because that's where they trade to the path. So apparently it's a lot of injuries. They keep reporting. They haven't gotten one when I stopped listening to the radio and realized, oh, my God, it's almost 10. Leapt out of my bed. I went, they hadn't had a count yet, but people were saying it was a lot. Because it was full steam ahead. So I'm going to guess that the conductor maybe had a heart attack or something like that because he hadn't braked. He just ran into a wall. And so at any rate, that energy, which is kind of chaotic energy, it's also a transformative. And it takes us back to September of 15, or not September, March of 215. And the story from then, too, because these eclipses are wrapping up that story. So in my case, that was when my sister got fired. And now you know, she just moved into her new house and completely settled in her life. So it's kind of an interesting, it's an interesting time. But it is an anxious energy. It's very kind of turbulent inside the key, the working with it. And Michael's told you how to calm the anxiety down from the astrology point of view. The key is to see where you can be responsible in the space.
Yeah, that's the same thing.
And to say, let me be responsible here, because then that Saturns it and grounds it a bit.
Well, so
this is what I can do.
Well, so the segue is that once you get yourself separated out and you've dealt with the anxiety, and you've just gone, you know, I'm here and I've connected with myself, which gives me a connection with all of my skills, then you turn your attention back to the situation. And you go, what's happening, and what are my options?
Right.
So it results in exactly what Anne is saying, that that you have, without all of the emotional distraction, or at least, you know, turning the volume down on that, you then go back and you take a more clear-headed and anchored look at what's happening, and you can ask, how can I be responsible here, or you can say, what are the options? And how do I hypothesize what the best option is? Mm-hmm. Knowing that the only control we ever have is to decide amongst options in the present. We have no control over the future or the past because we can only act in the present.
Right.
So when you've done that, you then, the thing I always try to remember is that, as I step into each new moment, I get to decide all over again. Because whatever I did is in the past. So I get to decide again.
Right.
So if you need to slow, you know, often people need to, if they're anxious, slowing down is very helpful. And if you slow down really a lot, you get to notice that you do have each new moment.
Right.
And you get to adjust your best choice in each new moment. So it's not necessarily true that once you commit to something, you're stuck.
Right. Because you're not. Because you can change your mind in the next moment.
Yes.
But in this moment, you're committed to working on it. And that's really the best thing you can do right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of decisions are hypotheses about what's going to work in the future.
Right. Right.
You know, I always try to make sure that my daughter knew that she was responsible once she committed to something to follow through and or ask and say, this isn't working, can we talk further about it?
Right. And as a result, she's gotten hundreds of promotions in her first, in her early career.
Yeah,
store looks at her and goes, oh, my God, you're responsible.
Yeah, she also tries to skeeze out of things with me still, but I just go, look, you know, do we need to
have more
discussion about this? We can always rearrange what's moving forward.
But her job is to practice skeeving out with you just so she can see how she can. Yeah, that's a good thing. That's every child. That means she loves you, Michael. Because every child tries and figures out how they get the parent to do what they want. It's like a wonderful game. Somebody once said to me, you know, squirrels with nuts on a tree, you know, with bird feeders, trying to figure out how to get the bird feeder. They spend 24 hours a day trying to get that bird seed. And children spend 24 hours a day, not really. But they love to figure out how they get their parents to kind of just move a little to the left.
Well, it's practicing for their relationship with the outside world.
With the outside world.
And when parents constantly cave in, they often are giving the children a lesson that if they keep trying something, they're going to prevail. And the outside world often teaches them, who are you, and that's not happening.
Right. Yeah, because they don't have the same relationship. Yeah. So the British lady said, we're done.
We are.
So big hugs, lots of love.
And to you. And feel better.
Yeah, I'm going to go have a cup of coffee now.
Okay.
And give myself some warm fluid and go see how many people were in New Jersey. So lots of love to all of you. We'll see you all next week, hopefully, assuming the stars prevail. And take care. This
you
is
too.
Scorpio's talking. Bye.
Bye.